a huge graveyard had been upended. And, like three wizened chimpanzees in tattered black suits that did up in the back, the Duke of Westminster, the Bishop of Bath and Wells, and the Honourable Archibald Fitzhugh were swinging from statue to stone, dangling Bod between them as they went, tossing him from one to another, never missing him, always catching him with ease, without even looking. Bod tried to look up to see the grave through which they had entered this strange world, but he could see nothing but headstones. He wondered if each of the graves they were swinging past was a door for the kind of people who were carrying him.
"Where are we going?"
he asked, but his voice was whipped away by the wind. They went faster and faster. Up ahead of them, Bod saw a statue swing up, and another two creatures came catapulting out into this crimson-skied world, just like the ones that carried Bod. One wore a raggedy silken gown that looked like it had once been white. The other wore a stained grey suit too large for it, the sleeves of which were shredded into shadowy tatters. They spotted Bod and his three new friends and made for them, dropping 20 feet with ease. The Duke of Westminster gave a guttural squawk and pretended to be scared, and Bod and the three of them swung down the wall of graves with the two new creatures in pursuit. None of them seemed to get tired or out of breath under that red sky, with the burnt-out sun gazing down at them like a dead eye. But eventually they fetched up on the side of a huge statue of a creature whose whole face seemed to have become a fungoid growth. Bod found himself being introduced to the 33rd President of the United States and the Emperor of China.
"This is Master Bod. He's going to become one of us.
He's in search of a good meal."
"Well, you're guaranteed fine dining when you becomes one of us, young lad,"
said the Emperor of China.
"Yup,"
said the 33rd President of the United States.
"I become one of you. You mean, I'll turn into you?"
"Smart as a whip, sharp as a tack. You'd have to get up pretty late at night to put anything past this lad. Indeed, one of us. As strong, as fast, as unconquerable.
Teeth so strong they can crush any bones, and tongue sharp and long enough to lick the marrow from the deepest marrow bone, or flay the flesh from a fat man's face.
Able to slip from shadow to shadow, never seen, never suspected, free as air, fast as thought, cold as frost, hard as nails, dangerous as us."
Bod looked at the creatures.
"But what if I don't want to be one of you?"
"Don't want to? Of course you want to. What could be finer? I don't think there's a soul in the universe doesn't want to be just like us."
"We've got the best city?"
"Gulheim."
"The best life? The best food?"
"Can you imagine how fine a drink the black ichor that collects in a leaden coffin can be? Or how it feels to be more important than kings and queens, than presidents or prime ministers or heroes, to be sure of it in the same way that people are more important than Brussels sprouts?"
"What are you people?"
"Ghouls. Bless me, somebody wasn't paying attention, was he? We're ghouls."
"Look!"
Below them, a whole troop of the little creatures were bouncing and running and leaping, heading for the path below them, and before he could say another word, he was snatched up by a pair of bony hands and was flying through the air in a series of jumps and lurches as the creatures headed down to meet the others of their kind. The wall of graves was ending, and now there was a road, and nothing but a road, a much-trodden path across a barren plain, a desert of rocks and bones, that wound towards a city, high on a huge red rock hill many miles away. Bod looked up at the city and was horrified. An emotion engulfed him that mingled repulsion and fear, disgust and loathing, all tinged with shock. Ghouls do not build. They are parasites and scavengers, eaters of carrion. The city they call Ghoulheim is something they found long ago, but did not make. No one knows, if anyone human ever knew, what kind of creatures it was that made those buildings, who honeycombed the rock with tunnels and towers. But it is certain that no one but the ghoul folk could have wanted to stay there, or even to approach that place. Even from the path below Ghoulheim, even from miles away, Bod could see that all of the angles were wrong, that the walls sloped crazily, that it was every nightmare he had ever endured made into a place, like a huge mouth of jutting teeth. It was a city that had been built just to be abandoned, in which all the fears and madnesses and revulsions of the creatures who built it were made into stone. The ghoul folk had found it, and delighted in it, and called it home. Ghouls move fast. They swarmed along the path, through the desert, more swiftly than a vulture flies, and Bod was carried along by them, held high overhead by a pair of strong ghoul arms, tossed from one to another, feeling sick, feeling dread and dismay, feeling stupid. Above them, in the sour red skies, things were circling on huge black wings.
"Careful! Tuck him away. Don't want the Night Gaunt stealing him, bloody stealers."
"Yeah, we hate stealers."
"Night Gaunts, in the red skies above Ghoulheim."
Bod took a deep breath and shouted, just as Miss Lupescu had taught him. He made a call like an eagle's cry in the back of his throat. One of the winged beasts dropped towards them, circled lower, and Bod made the call again, until it was stifled by hard hands clamping over his mouth.
"Good idea, calling them down, but trust me, they aren't edible until they've been rotting for at least a couple of weeks, and they just causes trouble. No love lost between our side and theirs, eh?"
The Night Gaunt rose again in the dry desert air to rejoin its fellows, and Bod felt all hope vanish. The ghouls sped on towards the city on the rocks, and Bod, now flung unceremoniously over the stinking shoulders of the Duke of Westminster, was carried with them. The dead sun set, and two moons rose. One, huge and pitted and white, which seemed, as it rose, to be taking up half the horizon, although it shrank as it ascended, and a smaller moon, the bluish-green colour of the veins of mould in a cheese. And the arrival of this moon was an occasion of celebration for the ghoul folk. They stopped marching and made a camp beside the road. One of the new members of the band, Bod thought it might have been the one he had been introduced to as the famous writer Victor Hugo, produced a sack, which turned out to be filled with firewood, several pieces still with the hinges or brass handles attached, along with a metal cigarette lighter, and soon made a fire, around which all the ghoul folk sat and rested. They stared up at the greenish-blue moon, and scuffled for the best places by the fire, insulting each other, sometimes clawing or biting.
"We'll sleep soon, then set off for Ghoulheim at moonset. It's just another 9 or 10 hours' run along the way. We should reach it by next moonrise. Then we'll have a party, eh? Celebrate you being made into one of us, ha ha!"
"It doesn't hurt, not so as you'd notice. And after, think how happy you'll be."
They all started telling stories then, of how fine and wonderful a thing it was to be a ghoul, of all the things they had crunched up and swallowed down with their powerful teeth. Impervious they were to disease or illness, said one of them. Why, it didn't matter what their dinner had died of, they could just chomp it down. They told of the places they had been, which mostly seemed to be catacombs and plague pits.
Plague pits is good eating.
And everyone agreed. They told Bod how they had got their names, and how he, in his turn, once he had become a nameless ghoul, would be named as they had been.
But I don't want to become one of you.
One way or another you'll become one of us. The other way is messier, involves being digested, and you're not really around very long to enjoy it.
But that's not a good thing to talk about. Best to be a ghoul. We're afraid of nothing.
And all the ghouls around the coffinwood fire howled at this statement, and growled, and sang, and exclaimed at how wise they were, and how mighty, and how fine it was to be scared of nothing. There was a noise then from the desert, from far away, a distant howl, and the ghouls gibbered, and they huddled closer to the flames.
What was that?
The ghouls shook their heads.
Just something out there in the desert? Quiet? It'll hear us?
And all the ghouls were quiet for a bit, until they forgot about the thing in the desert and began to sing ghoul song, filled with foul words and worse sentiments, the most popular of which were simply lists of which rotting body parts were to be eaten, and in what order.
I want to go home,
said Bod, when the last of the bits in the song had been consumed.
I don't want to be here.
Don't take on so. Why, you little coot, I promise you that as soon as you're one of us, you'll not ever remember as you even had a home.
I don't remember anything about the days before I was a ghoul,
said the famous writer Victor Hugo.
Nor I.
Nope.
You'll be one of a select band of the cleverest, strongest, bravest creatures ever.
Bod was unimpressed by the ghouls' bravery or their wisdom. They were strong, though, and inhumanly fast, and he was in the centre of a troop of them. Making a break for it would have been impossible. They would be able to catch up with him before he could cover a dozen yards. Far off in the night, something howled once more, and the ghouls moved closer to the fire. Bod could hear them, sniffling and cursing. He closed his eyes, miserable and homesick. He did not want to become one of the ghouls. He wondered how he would ever be able to sleep when he was this worried and hopeless. And then, almost to his surprise, for 2 or 3 hours he slept. A noise woke him, upset, loud, close. It was someone saying,
Well, where is they, hey?
He opened his eyes to see the Bishop of Bath and Wells shouting at the Emperor of China. It seemed that a couple of the members of their group had disappeared in the night, just vanished, and no one had an explanation. The rest of the ghouls were on edge. They packed up their camp quickly, and the 33rd President of the United States picked Bod up and bundled him over his shoulder. The ghouls scrabbled back down the rocky cliffs to the road, beneath a sky the colour of bad blood, and they headed towards Gulheim. They seemed significantly less exuberant this morning. Now they seemed, at least to Bod as he was bounced along, to be running away from something. Around midday, with a dead-eyed sun high overhead, the ghouls stopped and huddled. Ahead of them, high in the sky, circling on the hot air currents, were the night gaunts, dozens of them, riding the thermals. The ghouls divided into two factions. There were those who felt that the vanishing of their friends was meaningless, and those who believed that something, probably the Night Gaunts, was out to get them. They came to no agreement, except for a general agreement to arm themselves with rocks to throw at the Night Gaunts should they descend. And they filled the pockets of their suits and robes with pebbles from the desert floor. Something howled off in the desert to their left, and the ghouls eyed each other. It was louder than the night before, and closer, a deep, wolfish howl.
"Did you hear that?"
asked the Lord Mayor of London.
"Nope."
"Me neither."
The howl came again.
"We got to get home," said the Duke of Westminster, hefting a large stone.
The nightmare city of Ghoulheim sat on a high, rocky outcrop ahead of them, and the creatures loped down the road towards it.
"Night Gaunts coming! Throw stones at the bleeders!"
Dodd's view of things was upside down at this point, bouncing up and down on the back of the 33rd President of the United States. Gritty sand from the path blown up into his face. But he heard cries, like eagle cries, and once again Bod called for help in Night Gaunt. No one tried to stop him this time, but he was not sure that anyone could have heard him over the cries of the Night Gaunts or the oaths and curses of the ghoul folk as they pitched and flung their stones into the air. Bod heard the howling again. Now it came from their right.
"There's dozens of the blooming blinkers."
The 33rd President of the United States handed Bod over to the famous writer Victor Hugo, who threw the boy into his sack and put it over his shoulder. Bod was just glad the sack smelled of nothing worse than dusty wood.
"They're retreating. Look at them go."
"Don't you worry, boy,"
said a voice that sounded to Bod like the Bishop of Bath and Wells, near the sack.
"There won't be any of this nonsense when we get you to Ghoulheim. It's impenetrable, is Ghoulheim."
Bod could not tell if any of the ghouls had been killed or injured, fighting the Night Gaunts. He suspected, from the imprecations of the Bishop of Bath and Wells, that several more of the ghouls might have run off.
"Quickly!"
shouted someone, who was probably the Duke of Westminster, and the ghouls set off at a run. Bod, in the sack, was uncomfortable, being painfully slammed against the famous writer Victor Hugo's back, and occasionally banged on the ground. To make his time in the sack even more uncomfortable, there were still several lumps of wood, not to mention sharp screws and nails, in there with him. The final remnants of the coffin-based firewood. A screw was just under his hand, digging into him. Despite being jogged and jounced, jolted and jarred with every one of his captor's steps, Bod managed to grasp the screw in his right hand. He felt the tip of it, sharp to the touch. He hoped, deep inside. Then he pushed the screw into the fabric of the sack behind him, working the sharp end in, then pulling it back and making another hole a little way below the first. From behind, he could hear something howl once more, and it occurred to him that anything that could terrify the ghoul folk must itself be even more terrifying than he could imagine. And for a moment, he stopped stabbing with the screw. What if he fell from the sack into the jaws of some evil beast? But at least if he died, thought Bod, he would have died as himself, with all his memories, knowing who his parents were, who Silas was, even who Miss Lupescu was. That was good. He attacked the sacking with his brass screw again, jabbing and pushing until he made another hole in the fabric.
"Come on, lads, up the steps, and then we're home, all safe in Ghoulheim."
"Hooray, your worship,"
called someone else, probably the Honourable Archibald Fitzhugh. Now the motion of his captors had changed. It was no longer a forward motion. Now it was a sequence of movements up and along, up and along. Bod pushed at the sacking with his hand to try and make an eye hole. He looked out. Above, the drear red sky. Below, he could see the desert floor. But it was now hundreds of feet below him. There were steps stretching out behind them, but steps made for giants, and the ochre rock wall to his right. Gullheim, which Bod could not see from where he was, had to be above them. To his left was a sheer drop. He was going to have to fall straight down, he decided, onto the steps, and he would just hope that the ghouls wouldn't notice that he was making his break for it, in their desperation to be home and safe. He saw night gaunts, high in the red sky, hanging back, circling. He was pleased to see there were no other ghouls behind him. The famous writer Victor Hugo was bringing up the rear, and no one was behind him to alert the ghouls to the hole that was growing in the sack, or to see Bod if he fell out. But there was something else. Bod was bounced onto his side away from the hole, but he had seen something, huge and grey, on the steps beneath, pursuing them. He could hear an angry, growling noise. Mr. Owens had an expression for two things he found equally unpleasant.
"I'm between the devil and the deep blue sea,"
he would say. Bod had wondered what this meant, having seen in his life in the graveyard neither the devil nor the deep blue sea.
"I'm between the ghouls and the monster."
And as he thought it, sharp canine teeth caught at the sacking, pulled at it until the fabric tore along the rips Bod had made, and the boy tumbled down on the rock stairs, where a huge grey animal, like a dog but far larger, growled and drooled and stood over him. An animal with flaming eyes and white fangs and huge paws. It panted, and it stared at Bod. Ahead of him, the ghouls had stopped.
"Bloody Nora! That hellhound's got the blinking boy!"
"Let it have him! Run!
Yikes!"
The ghouls ran up the steps. Bod was now certain that the steps had been carved by giants, for each step was higher than he was. As they fled, the ghouls paused only to turn and make rude gestures at the beast, and possibly also at Bod. The beast stayed where it was.
"It's going to eat me,"
Bod thought bitterly.
"Smart, Bod."
And he thought of his home in the graveyard, and now he could no longer remember why he had ever left. Monster dog or no monster dog, he had to get back home once more. There were people waiting for him. He pushed past the beast, jumped down to the next step 4 feet below, fell his height, landed on his ankle, which twisted underneath him painfully, and he dropped heavily onto the rock. He could hear the beast running, jumping down towards him, and he tried to wriggle away, to pull himself up onto his feet. But his ankle was useless now, numb and in pain, and before he could stop himself, he fell again. He fell off the step, away from the rock wall, out into space, off the cliffside, where he dropped, a nightmarish tumble down distances that Bod could not even imagine. And as he fell, he was certainly heard a voice coming from the general direction of the grey beast, and it said, in Miss Lupescu's voice,
"Oh, Bod!"
It was like every dream of falling he had ever had. A scared and frantic drop through space as he headed towards the ground below. Bod felt as though his mind was only big enough for one huge thought, so...
That big dog was actually Miss Lupescu.
And...
I'm going to hit the rock floor and splat.
Competed in his head for occupation. Something wrapped itself about him, falling at the same speed he was falling. And then there was the loud flapping of leathery wings, and everything slowed. The ground no longer seemed to be heading towards him at the same speed. The wings flapped harder. They lifted slightly. And now the only thought in Bod's head was,
"I'm flying!"
And he was. He turned his head. Above him was a dark brown head, perfectly bald, with deep eyes that looked as if they were polished slabs of black glass. Bod made the screeching noise that means "help" in Nightgaunt, and the Nightgaunt smiled and made a deep hooting noise in return. It seemed pleased. A swoop and a slow, and they touched down on the desert floor with a thump. Bod tried to stand up, and his ankle betrayed him once again, sent him stumbling down into the sand. The wind was high, and the sharp desert sand blew hard, stinging Bod's skin. The Nightgaunt crouched beside him, its leathery wings folded on its back. Bod had grown up in a graveyard and was used to images of winged people, but the angels on the headstones looked nothing like this. And now, bounding toward them across the desert floor, in the shadow of Gulheim, a huge grey beast, like an enormous dog. The dog spoke in Miss Lupescu's voice.
"This is the third time the Nightgaunts have saved your life, Bod. The first was when you called for help and they heard. They got the message to me, telling me where you were. The second was around the fire last night, when you were asleep. They were circling in the darkness and heard a couple of the ghouls saying that you were ill luck for them, and that they should beat your brains in with a rock and put you somewhere they could find you again when you were properly rotted down, and then they would eat you. The Nightgaunts dealt with the matter silently. And now this."
"Miss Lupescu?"
The great dog-like head lowered towards him, and for one mad, fear-filled moment, he thought she was going to take a bite out of him. But her tongue licked the side of his face affectionately.
"You hurt your ankle?"
"Yes. I can't stand on it."
"Let's get you onto my back,"
said the huge grey beast. It was Miss Lupescu. She said something in the Nightgaunt's screeching tongue, and it came over, held Bod up while he put his arms around Miss Lupescu's neck.
"Hold my fur. Hold tight. Now, before we go, say..."
And she made a high, screeching noise.
"What does it mean?"
"Thank you, or goodbye. Both."
Bod screeched as best as he could, and the Nightgaunt made an amused chuckle. Then it made a similar noise, and it spread its great leathery wings, and it ran into the desert wind, flapping hard, and the wind caught it and carried it aloft, like a kite that had begun to fly.
"Now,"
said the beast that was Miss Lupescu,
"hold on tightly."
And she began to run.
"Are we going to the Wall of Graves?"
"To the ghoul gates? No. Those are for ghouls. I am a hound of God. I travel my own road, into hell and out of it."
And it seemed to Bod as if she ran even faster then. The huge moon rose, and the smaller mold-coloured moon, and they were joined by a ruby-red moon. And the grey wolf ran at a steady lope beneath them, across the desert of bones. She stopped by a broken clay building, like an enormous beehive, built beside a small rill of water that came bubbling out of the desert rock, splashed down into a tiny pool, and was gone again. The grey wolf put her head down and drank, and Bod scooped water up in his hands, drinking the water in a dozen tiny gulps.
"This is the boundary,"
said the grey wolf that was Miss Lupescu, and Bod looked up. The three moons had gone, Now he could see the Milky Way. See it as he had never seen it before, a glimmering shroud across the arch of the sky. The sky was filled with stars.
They're beautiful.
When we get you home, I teach you the names of the stars and their constellations.
I like that.
Bod clambered onto her huge grey back once more, and he buried his face in her fur and held on tightly, and it seemed only moments later that he was being carried, awkwardly as a grown woman carries a 6-year-old boy, across the graveyard to the Owens's tomb.
He's hurt his ankle.
Poor little soul,
said Mistress Owens, taking the boy from her and cradling him in her capable, if insubstantial, arms.
I can't say I didn't worry, for I did. But he's back now, and that's all that matters.
And then he was perfectly comfortable, beneath the earth, in a good place, with his head on his own pillow, and a gentle, exhausted darkness took him. Bod's left ankle was swollen and purple. Dr. Trefusis, 1870 to 1936, may he wake to glory, inspected it and pronounced it merely sprained. Miss Lupescu returned from a journey to the chemist's with a tight ankle bandage, and Josiah Worthington, Baronet, who had been buried with his ebony walking cane, insisted on lending it to Bod, who had too much fun leaning on the stick and pretending to be 100 years old. Bod limped up the hill and retrieved a folded piece of paper from beneath a stone. "The Hounds of God," he read. It was printed in a purple ink and was the first item on a list. "Those that men call werewolves or lycanthropes call themselves the Hounds of God, as they claim their transformation is a gift from their Creator, and they repay the gift with their tenacity, for they will pursue an evildoer to the very gates of hell." Bod nodded.
"Not just evildoers."
He read the rest of the list, committing it to memory as best he could, then went down to the chapel, where Miss Lupescu was waiting for him, with a small meat pie and a huge bag of chips she had brought from the fish and chip shop at the bottom of the hill, and another pile of purple-inked, duplicated lists. The two of them shared the chips, and once or twice Miss Lupescu even smiled. Silas came back at the end of the month. He carried his black bag in his left hand, and he held his right arm stiffly. But he was Silas, and Bod was happy to see him, and even happier when Silas gave him a present, a little model of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. It was almost midnight, and it was still not fully dark. The three of them sat at the top of the hill with the lights of the city glimmering beneath them.
"I trust that all went well in my absence?"
"I learned a lot,"
said Bod, still holding his bridge. He pointed up into the night sky.
"That's the big bear and her son, the little bear. That's Draco the dragon, snaking between them."
"Very good."
"And you? Did you learn anything while you were away?"
"Oh, yes."
But he declined to elaborate.
I also learned things."
"Good."
An owl hooted in the branches of an oak tree.
"You know, I heard rumours while I was away that some weeks ago you both went somewhat further afield than I would have been able to follow. Normally, I would advise caution, but, unlike some, the ghoul folk have short memories."
"It's okay. Miss Lupescu looked after me. I was never in any danger."
Miss Lupescu looked at Bod, and her eyes shone. Then she looked at Silas.
There are so many things to know. Perhaps I come back next year, in high summer also, to teach the boy again.
Silas looked at Miss Lupescu, and he raised an eyebrow a fraction. Then he looked at Bod.
I like that.
Chapter 4 The Witch's Headstone. There was a witch buried at the edge of the graveyard. It was common knowledge. Bod had been told to keep away from that corner of the world by Mrs. Owens, as far back as he could remember.
Why?
'Tain't healthy for a living body. There's damp down that end of things. It's practically a marsh. You'll catch a death.
Mr. Owens himself was more evasive and less imaginative.
It's not a good place.
The graveyard proper ended at the bottom of the west side of the hill, beneath the old apple tree, with a fence of rust-brown iron railings, each topped with a small rusting spearhead. But there was a wasteland beyond that, a mass of nettles and weeds, of brambles and autumnal rubbish, and Bod, who was on the whole obedient, did not push between the railings, but he went down there and looked through. He knew he wasn't being told the whole story, and it irritated him. Bod went back up the hill to the little chapel near the entrance to the graveyard, and he waited until it got dark. As twilight edged from grey to purple, there was a noise in the spire, like a fluttering of heavy velvet, and Silas left his resting place in the belfry and clambered head first down the spire.
What's in the far corner of the graveyard? Past Harrison Westwood, baker of this parish, and his wives Marion and Joan?
Why do you ask?
Said his guardian, brushing the dust from his black suit with ivory fingers. Bod shrugged.
Just wondered.
It's unconsecrated ground. Do you know what that means?
Not really.
Silas walked across the path without disturbing a fallen leaf and sat down on the bench beside Bod.
There are those who believe that all land is sacred, that it is sacred before we come to it and sacred after. But here, in your land, they blessed the churches and the ground they set aside to bury people in, to make it holy. But they left land unconsecrated beside the sacred ground, potter's fields to bury the criminals and the suicides, or those who were not of the faith.
So the people buried in the ground on the other side of the fence are bad people?
Silas raised one perfect eyebrow.
Hmm? Oh, not at all. Let's see. It's been a while since I've been down that way, but I don't remember anyone particularly evil. Remember, in days gone by, you could be hanged for stealing a shilling. And there are always people who find their lives have become so unsupportable, they believe the best thing they could do would be to hasten their transition to another plane of existence.
They kill themselves, you mean?
He was about 8 years old, wide-eyed and inquisitive, and he was not stupid.
Indeed.
Does it work? Are they happy or dead?
Sometimes, mostly no. It's like the people who believe they'll be happy if they go and live somewhere else, but who learn it doesn't work that way. Wherever you go, you take yourself with you. If you see what I mean.
Sort of.
Silas reached down and ruffled the boy's hair.
What about the witch?
Yes, exactly. Suicides, criminals, and witches. Those who died unshriven.
He stood up, a midnight shadow in the twilight.
All this talking, and I have not even had my breakfast, while you will be late for lessons.
In the twilight of the graveyard, there was a silent implosion, a flutter of velvet darkness, and Silas was gone. The moon had begun to rise by the time Bod reached Mr. Pennyworth's mausoleum, and Thomas Pennyworth, here he lies in the certainty of the most glorious resurrection, was already waiting, and was not in the best of moods.
You are late.
Sorry, Mr. Pennyworth.
Pennyworth tutted. The previous week, Mr. Pennyworth had been teaching Bod about elements and humours, and Bod had kept forgetting which was which. He was expecting a test, but instead, Mr. Pennyworth said,
I think it is time to spend a few days on practical matters. Time is passing, after all.
Is it?
I'm afraid so, young Master Owens. Now, how is your fading?
Bod had hoped he would not be asked that question.
It's all right. I mean, you know.
No, Master Owens, I do not know. Why do you not demonstrate for me?
Bod's heart sank. He took a deep breath and did his best, squinching up his eyes and trying to fade away. Mr. Pennyworth was not impressed.
That's not the kind of thing. Not the kind of thing at all. Slipping and fading, boy, the way of the dead. Slip through shadows. Fade from awareness. Try again.
Bod tried harder.
You're as plain as the nose on your face, and your nose is remarkably obvious. As is the rest of your face, young man. As are you. For the sake of all that is holy, empty your mind. Now, you are an empty alleyway. You are a vacant doorway. You are nothing. Eyes will not see you. Minds will not hold you. Where you are is nothing and nobody.
Bod tried again. He closed his eyes and imagined himself fading into the stained stonework of the mausoleum wall, becoming a shadow on the night and nothing more. He sneezed.
Ah, dreadful. Quite dreadful. I believe I shall have a word with your guardian about this.
He shook his head.
So, the humours. List them.
Sanguine, choleric, phlegmatic, and the other one, melancholic, I think.
And so it went, until it was time for grammar and composition, with Miss Letitia Burrows, spinster of this parish, who did no harm to no man all the days of her life. Reader, can you say likewise? Bod liked Miss Burrows, and the cosiness of her little crypt, and that she could all too easily be led off the subject.
They say there's a witch in unconsecrated ground.
Yes, dear, but you don't want to go over there.
Why not?
Miss Burrows smiled, the guileless smile of the dead.
They aren't our sort of people.
But it is the graveyard, isn't it? I mean, I'm allowed to go there if I want to.
That would not be advisable.
Bod was obedient, but curious. And so, when lessons were done for the night, he walked past Harrison Westwood, Baker and Family's memorial, a broken-armed angel, but did not climb down the hill to the potter's field. Instead, he walked up the side of the hill to where a picnic, some 30 years before, had left its mark in the shape of a large apple tree. There were some lessons that Bod had mastered. He had eaten a bellyful of unripe apples, sour and white-pipped, from the tree some years before, and had regretted it for days, his guts cramping and painful, while Mrs. Owens lectured him on what not to eat. Now he always waited until the apples were ripe before eating them, and never ate more than 2 or 3 a night. He had finished the last of the apples the week before, but he liked the apple tree as a place to think. He edged up the trunk to his favourite place in the crook of 2 branches, and looked down at the potter's field below him, a brambly patch of weeds and unmown grass in the moonlight. He wondered whether the witch would be old and iron-toothed and travel in a house on chicken legs, or whether she would be thin and sharp-nosed and carry a broomstick. Bod's stomach growled, and he realized that he was getting hungry. He wished he had not devoured all the apples on the tree, that he had left just one. He glanced up and thought he saw something. He looked once, looked twice to be certain. An apple, red and ripe. Bod prided himself on his tree-climbing skills. He swung himself up branch by branch and imagined he was Silas, swarming smoothly up a sheer brick wall. The apple, the red of it almost black in the moonlight, hung just out of reach. Bod moved slowly forward along the branch until he was just below the apple. Then he stretched up and the tips of his fingers touched the perfect apple. He was never to taste it. A snap, loud as a hunter's gun, as the branch gave way beneath him. A flash of pain woke him, sharp as ice, the colour of slow thunder, down in the weeds that summer's night. The ground beneath him seemed relatively soft and oddly warm. He pushed a hand down and felt something like warm fur beneath him. He had landed on the grass pile, where the graveyard's groundskeeper threw the cuttings from the mower, and it had broken his fall. Still, there was a pain in his chest, and his leg hurt as if he had landed on it first and twisted it. Bod moaned.
"Hush a you, hush a boy,"
said a voice from behind him.
"Where did you come from, dropping like a thunderstone? What way is that to carry on?"
"I was in the apple tree."
"Ah, let me see your leg. Broken like the tree's limb, I'll be bound."
Cool fingers prodded his left leg.
"Not broken. Twisted. Yes, sprained, perhaps. You have the devil's own luck, boy, falling into the compost. 'Tain't the end of the world."
"Oh, good. Hurts, though."
He turned his head, looked up and behind him. She was older than him, but not a grown-up, and she looked neither friendly nor unfriendly. Wary, mostly. She had a face that was intelligent, and not even a little bit beautiful.
"I'm Bod."
"The live boy?"
Bod nodded.
"I thought you must be. We've heard of you, even over here in the potter's field. What do they call you?"
"Owens. Nobody Owens. Bod for short."
"Howdy do, young Master Bod."
Bod looked her up and down. She wore a plain white shift. Her hair was mousy and long, and there was something of the goblin in her face. A sideways hint of a smile that seemed to linger, no matter what the rest of her face was doing.
"Were you a suicide? Did you steal a shilling?"
"Never stole nothing, not even a handkerchief. Anyway, the suicides is all over there, on the other side of that hawthorn, and the gallows birds are in the blackberry patch, both of them. One was a coiner, t'other a highwayman, or so he says.
although if you ask me, I doubt he was more than a common footpad and nightwalker.
Oh.
Then, suspicion forming...
They say a witch is buried here.
She nodded.
Drowned and burned and buried here without as much as a stone to mark the spot.
You were drowned and burned.
She settled down on the hill of grass cuttings beside him and held his throbbing leg with her chilly hands.
They come to my little cottage at dawn, before I'm proper awake, and drags me out onto the green. You're a witch, they shouts. Fat and fresh scrubbed, all pink in the morning, like so many pigwiggins scrubbed clean for market day. One by one, they gets up beneath the sky and tells of milk gone sour and horses gone lame. And finally, Mistress Jemima gets up, the fattest, pinkest, best scrubbed of them all, and tells how a Solomon Porritt now cuts her dead and instead hangs around the washhouse like a wasp about a honey pot. And it's all my magic, says she, that made him so, and the poor young man must be bespelled. So they strap me to the cucking stool and forces it under the water of the duck pond, saying if I'm a witch, I'll neither drown nor care, but if I am not a witch, I'll feel it. And Mistress Jemima's father gives them each a silver groat to hold the stool down under the foul green water for a long time to see if I'd choke on it.
And did you?
Oh, yes. Got a lungful of water. It done for me.
Oh, then you weren't a witch after all.
The girl fixed him with her beady ghost eyes and smiled a lopsided smile. She still looked like a goblin, but now she looked like a pretty goblin. And Bod didn't think she would have needed magic to attract Solomon Porritt. Not with a smile like that.
What nonsense. Of course I was a witch. They learned that when they untied me from the cooking stool and stretched me on the green, nine parts dead and all covered with duckweed and stinking pond muck. I rolled my eyes back in my head and I cursed each and every one of them there on the village green that morning, that none of them would ever rest easily in a grave. I was surprised at how easily it came, the cursing. Like dancing it was, when your feet pick up the steps of a new measure your ears have never heard and your head don't know, and they dance it till dawn.
She stood and twirled and kicked, and her bare feet flashed in the moonlight.
That was how I cursed them, with my last gurgling pond watery breath. And then I expired. They burned my body on the green until I was nothing but blackened charcoal, and they popped me in a hole in the potter's field, without so much as a headstone to mark my name.
And it was only then that she paused, and seemed, for a moment, wistful.
Are any of them buried in the graveyard, then?
Not a one. The Saturday after they drowned and toasted me, a carpet was delivered to Master Porringer, all the way from London town, and it was a fine carpet. But it turned out there was more in that carpet than strong wool and good weaving, for it carried the plague in its pattern. And by Monday, five of them were coughing blood, and their skins were gone as black as mine when they hauled me from the fire. A week later, and it had taken most of the village, and they threw the bodies all promiscuous in a plague pit they dug outside of the town that they filled in after.
Was everyone in the village killed?
She shrugged.
Everyone who watched me get drowned and burned. How's your leg now?
Better, thanks.
Bod stood up, slowly, and limped down from the grass pile. He leaned against the iron railings.
So, were you always a witch? I mean, before you cursed them all.
As if it would take witchcraft to get Solomon Porritt mooning round my cottage.
Which, Bod thought, but did not say, was not actually an answer to the question. Not at all.
What's your name?
Got no headstone,
she said, turning down the corners of her mouth.
Might be anybody. Mightn't I?
But you must have a name.
Liza Hempstock, if you please. It's not that much to ask, is it? Something to mark my grave. I'm just down there, see? With nothing but nettles to show where I rest.
And she looked so sad, just for a moment, that Bard wanted to hug her. And then it came to him, as he squeezed between the railings of the fence. He would find Liza Hemstock a headstone, with her name upon it. He would make her smile. He turned to wave goodbye as he began to clamber up the hill, but she was already gone. There were broken lumps of other people's stones and statues in the graveyard, but Bod knew that would have been entirely the wrong sort of thing to bring to the grey-eyed witch in the potter's field. It was going to take more than that. He decided not to tell anyone what he was planning, on the not entirely unreasonable basis that they would have told him not to do it. Over the next few days, his mind filled with plans, each more complicated and extravagant than the last. Mr. Pennyworth despaired.
"I do believe,"
he announced, scratching his dusty moustache,
"that you are getting, if anything, worse. You are not fading. You are obvious, boy. You are difficult to miss. If you came to me in company with a purple lion, a green elephant and a scarlet unicorn, astride which was the King of England in his royal robes, I do believe that it is you, and you alone, that people would stare at, dismissing the others as minor irrelevancies."
Bod simply stared at him and said nothing. He was wondering whether there were special shops in the places where the living people gathered that sold only headstones. And if so, how he could go about finding one. And fading was the least of his problems. He took advantage of Miss Bodder's willingness to be diverted from the subjects of grammar and composition to the subject of anything else at all, to ask her about money. How exactly it worked. How one used it to get things one wanted. Bod had a number of coins he had found over the years. He had learned that the best place to find money was to go, afterwards, to whatever courting couples had used the grass of the graveyard as a place to cuddle and snuggle and kiss and roll about. He would often find metal coins on the ground in the place where they had been, and he thought perhaps he could finally get some use from them.
"How much would a headstone be?"
"In my time, they were 15 guineas. I do not know what they would be today. More, I imagine. Much, much more."
Bod had £2.53. It would, he was quite certain, not be enough. It had been 4 years, almost half a lifetime, since Bod had visited the Indigo Man's tomb. But he still remembered the way. He climbed to the top of the hill until he was above the whole town, above even the top of the apple tree, above even the steeple of the little chapel, up where the Frobisher mausoleum stood like a rotten tooth. He slipped down into it, behind the coffin, and down and down and still further down, down to the tiny stone steps cut into the centre of the hill, and those he descended until he reached the stone chamber. It was dark in that tomb, dark as a tin mine, but Bod saw as the Dead Sea, and the room gave up its secrets to him. The slear was coiled around the wall of the barrow. He could feel it. It was, as he remembered it, an invisible thing, all smoky tendrils and hate and greed. This time, however, he was not afraid of it.
"Fear us, for we guard things precious and never lost."
"I don't fear you, remember? And I need to take something away from here."
"Nothing
came the reply from the coiled thing in the darkness.
"The knife, the brooch, Slayer Goblet. The Slayer guards them in the darkness. We wait.
Pardon me.